Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, and we bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today we have a special guest, a writing teacher, novelist, and author services consultant. She is Stephanie Austin Edwards. Stephanie is a former dancer and costumer, and her 22-year career in theater began in San Diego and moved her to New York City. In New York, she worked on Broadway, in film, and on television with such talents as Liza Minnelli, Michael Jackson, Lauren Bacall, Woody Allen, Martin Scorsese, Hal Prince, Stephen Sondheim, Bill Cosby, and Michael Bennett. And later, she returned to her roots in the South Carolina Lowcountry, where she, when not writing or cruising down the river with her husband, facilitates writers' groups and teaches writing workshops. Her book, What We Set in Motion, her debut novel, won a Best Submission Award at the Atlanta's Writers Club Conference in 2013. And I am so thrilled to share her with you, so let's bring her on. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Well, thank you, Pat.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to this. Now, Stephanie, this is your debut novel about a young woman coming of age searching for independence. Share a bit of your synopsis.
The story takes place in the turbulent 1970s, although it could be a story today as well. And it's kind of a theme that I think a lot of people might have experienced, in that after college, my protagonist, Nadine Carter Barnwell, is faced with, do I follow my own heart and my own dream, or do I do what my family expects me to do, what my society, what my hometown expects me to do? And if I do that second one, I feel like I will wither and die. And therefore, what do I do? So Nadine is faced with that challenge. Her mother is passed on. Her father is very adamant that they're from a prominent family that goes back to the Civil War. And he expects Nadine to come and take over the business and carry on the family name. And she, after college, has just had her horizons expanded, and she wants to take the leap of faith and go to New York City and dance. But Daddy is so angry with her at the beginning of the novel, and he says, if you go anyway, don't ever come back.
Ooh. So what prompted you to write this?
Well, they always say, write what you know. That part of the story about a parent or someone telling me not to do something is not part of my life. I did go to New York to dance, but I'm, you know, one of many who went after a theater or an art career. In the South, where I actually feel like I am more from the South than anywhere else, because I moved around a lot as a child, I went to high school, middle school and high school here, and I have deep roots in this part of the country. But then I did spend 22 years in New York City. And so over the years, I thought, well, you know, there's an interesting story here. Everybody has a different story about how they got to New York, what they encountered, what the obstacles were. And a lot of times you saw people who, okay, some did okay. They moved up the ladder, their career built. Other people just got scared and said, ooh, this is way too overwhelming for me, and I'm getting out of here. And they didn't really give it a shot. And then you got that third group, the ones who stayed too long. Huh. They didn't really have what it took for what they thought they wanted to do. Not to say they wouldn't have some other wonderful piece of life to follow, but then they stayed too long pursuing a dream that wasn't really theirs, and their lives spiraled into another direction altogether. And in the novel, Nadine's friend Denny goes to New York with her, and where Nadine goes to work on setting her life in motion, the life she wants, Denny's life goes a little bit the other way, and you see the contrast of two people that came from the same origin with the same dream and how going after it affected them so differently.
Mm-hmm. Very true to life. I think a lot of people can relate to this, having that feeling that they want to bust out of where they are and go do something that they think is exciting, that is their dream, and has many choices as to ways that it does actually turn out.
Absolutely true. And the people who've read the book have given me comments such as, if I had read this book 40 years ago, I wonder if I would have pursued my dream differently.
Interesting.
Which I think is a wonderful comment to make. And that's for that person in particular, I think, of having a really beautiful life, having made certain choices that maybe I didn't make. But there's a longing in all of us for maybe something a little bit out of the traditional. And you only get a couple of chances to really give that a try.
Absolutely. Now, your first chapter has a quote, "Choices are our destiny." And I thought those are four powerful words. Let's talk about that for a bit.
Oh, good. I'm so glad you like that quote. Each chapter actually has a different quote at the beginning.
Yes.
I spent a good bit of time researching what I thought belonged for each chapter. But choices are our destiny. We are not necessarily carried along by life just willy-nilly. We have a choice almost in every moment of our life. And so if we put our mind to what it is that we're looking for in the long run, not to say that we're looking for a dream that isn't right for us or nirvana or anything like that, but we can shape a life that is actually quite beautiful. But you have to also understand that there's going to be obstacles, and obstacles are part of the process. And so Nadine, in this story, goes through lots of obstacles. There are people coming after her. They're chasing her in certain scenes. And then there are people trying to get her to do illegal things. All the ways that artists are trying to survive and make a living, there's all kinds of predators coming in at the same time to pull people away. So the choices that you make in each one of these situations tells you really how your life is going. And it can become daunting. It can become like, okay, I don't have any money here. Maybe I will take this thing that maybe is a little bit shady or takes me away from my art. It might not be shady at all, but might take me away from my art. And then how will I feel down the road where I kind of gave up on that whole thing?
No, I thought that was powerful. And yeah, I really appreciated all the quotes you had at the beginning of each chapter. I think that was a great way to begin every chapter.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, having worked on Broadway with some of the greats, is there a bit of you or is there a bit of them in the characters or a bit of some scenarios that happened to you along the way?
Well, what I like to say when people ask that question, and they well should, it's written in first person. And it was originally written in third person, and I had an editor along the way said, you might want to try this in first person. And it gave it an immediacy, a beautiful immediacy once I changed it over. It was just a lot of work to do that. When you write it in first person and you have been to New York and been a dancer, people say, oh, well, this is your story.
Mm-hmm.
Not my story. None of the surrounding characters are anybody I ever knew. They are all composites. And I think that we make up our characters out of pieces, bits and pieces of different people we've known over time. We might have met them in person. We might have observed them and not really gotten to know them. We might have been told about them. We might have seen them in a movie, read them in a book. You're not even sure necessarily where all those bits and pieces came from, but the composite starts forming into a character. And, this took me a good while to get this first novel out. And I probably wrote three versions of it in the time that it took me to make this one gel. Mm-hmm. That's what I like to say. And I didn't really change, I guess, the storyline itself, but it did get shaped beautifully, more beautifully as I kept working on it. And so nobody in particular is in this book that was in my life.
Okay, yeah.
Including me.
That's always a thought when you read something. You try to, as a reader, pick out the pieces, think, oh, I wonder if that really happened.
Yeah, well, then that's not to say that there aren't scenes.
Sure.
What I want to say is places that are real. Mm-hmm. But I moved characters around. There's a coffee shop in this story that is very prominent, almost like a person itself, I think the coffee shop is. And there was a coffee shop similar to that when I was there back in the 70s.
Interesting.
But none of the characters that you met in that coffee shop, none of the things that happened in that coffee shop in my book actually happened in real life. But it was a great springboard, and it was almost like the Cheers bar, something like that. It was something that gathered people together.
Right, right.
A place to meet.
Good fodder for a book.
Yeah.
Yes. So how did you know when your book was done? You worked on it three times. When did you realize, okay, I'm done?
Yeah. Well, I'd gotten all the way to the end, but, you know, I think the last editor that I had, we did it very slowly. It was a wonderful process where sometimes you can hire an editor and you send the whole thing off, and then it comes back with these mounds of notes and red pen marks, you know, and you look at it and your eyes circle. It's just like, oh my God, how am I ever going to get through all this? And so I've done that a couple of times, and it certainly helped because the process of writing a novel is daunting. There's no doubt about it. It is daunting until you've done it at least the first time, and it probably is going to be daunting the second time as well. But then the editor that I used last, who has talked for Writer's Digest and written her own books and has her own studio in Wisconsin, she did a process with me where we worked on it each week, and we did 20 pages a week. And her name is Kathy Giorgio, and that was just such a wonderful process because it made me slow down. It made me really totally take a look at it 20 pages at a time, you know, and for someone else to look at it that way also.
Yes.
And so I loved that process. And so I got the notes on each of that, and I could go back and see how things connected or disconnected. You know, you're not sure sometimes if your timelines are right, and could this really have happened in this time frame the way that you've got it set up? And did somebody else seeing something you're not seeing, you know, to help flush out those things? And then toward the end, even though I read it in my writer's group for many years, I read bits and pieces of it certainly, never read it all the way through. So the last quarter of the book, at least, where the pace really ramps up when a letter from a mysterious person shows up in Nadine's mailbox and things just go in a whole other direction. Well, that pace revved up, and it finally floated me, or do you want to say drove me to the end, and it kind of just wrapped itself up. That's when the muse really takes over.
Yes.
The muse really stepped in and said, you know, this is where I think you need to go with this.
Oh, how exciting. Well, now, we mentioned prior to coming on the air about your reading a little snippet from it. So why don't you go ahead if you've got that queued up and ready?
Okay.
I'd like that.
This is in chapter one, and I'm not going to read the actual argument between Nadine and her father. I'm going to skip a little bit forward where they started this argument, and she's saying finally to her father, who she has loved and adored her whole life, but knows what he wants for her to do. And so he said some bad things and she said some bad things. And this is, I'm going to move forward from there. They're definitely at an impasse. And this is Daddy speaking. Get rid of that boy, Nadine Bonwell. You are not moving to New York City, and that is final. Before I could say anything else, he snapped his paper closed and walked out of the room. I turned and clenched the back of the chair to try to keep from exploding. Then spewing out of me like hot lava, I heard myself say what I had never let myself say before. You're not going to hold me here like a prisoner to your view of life. There's a new world out there beyond the South, and I'm going to dance whether you like it or not. His fading footsteps stopped. No, you are not, he shouted back. Then, as if invisible, hidden or omnipotent, he called out from the shadows, if you go anyway, don't ever come back. I wanted to throw that same chair at him, but didn't. Instead, I picked up my bag, slipped through the patio doors, and hurried across the manicured lawn. On the dock, I stopped, bent over, and took several deep breaths. The whole float rocked as my black lab bear raced down the ramp and screeched to a halt at my feet. I felt and smelled his warm breath in my hair, heard his nails clicking as he stepped up and down in excitement. Then I lifted myself up and, with Bear at my heels, paced several lengths of the splintered planks, trying to push away my anger. A tightness settled in my chest and neck muscles, blocking my thinking. But after a few minutes, my focus returned, and as clear as a lightning bolt in the sky, I knew what to do. I needed to get to Aunt Amelia right away and tell her what Daddy just said. What I said, ask her to help me figure out what, if anything, I could or should do next. If Daddy didn't care if I ever came back, I didn't care if he knew where I was going. But I did follow one more rule. After writing my destination on the covered chalkboard, a mandatory requirement for all boats leaving our dock, I quietly untied my bateau from its cleat, stepped in and pushed off. Bear paced the dock looking for a place to jump into the boat. No, you can't go this time. I'll be back tomorrow, I shouted as if he understood English. His sad eyes watched me float out into the creek without him. The boat drifted silently for several minutes before I pulled the cord on the Johnson 50-horsepower motor. It was just enough time to get to Camp Pinckney, our remote family fish camp, on an island without roads or bridges before the blackness of the Sea Island set in. Tears clouded my vision as I steered the bateau through a series of creeks to get to more open water. I wiped my eyes with the back of my sleeve until my sight cleared up. Because the brackish water was so cloudy, it wasn't easy to know exactly where the deepest parts of the creek were. Depending on the tide level, mudflats and oyster roots could be just under the surface, waiting to catch a prop or a keel. Once caught, a boat could be kept firmly in place, stranded for many hours while the tide went all the way out and back in, just enough to float once again. That's when I realized that if I wasn't careful, I was going to be stuck in the plough mud forever, and no tide change was going to set my boat free. The sound of dolphin spray caught my attention. I turned in time to see four of them arcing out of the water in micro intervals, then curving back down, nose first, like a line of synchronized swimmers diving into a pool. Daddy and I used to love to come out at feeding time and watch for dolphin pods. When I first asked what a pod was, he told me they were family. I knew what family meant to him, even if he had lost his ability to show love. Whenever he and his friends got together, they always fell into bragging bouts about who was the most southern, who was the purest Bufotonian. According to Daddy, his grandfather, Ebenezer Barnwell, went through hell and back, determined to regain the empire he and his family built and then lost. A great-grandfather, grandfather, and great-uncles worked tirelessly to rebuild their lives. They had a vision and an unwavering focus stemming from an understandable fire of hatred and revenge. How many times had I heard this story? Or couldn't Daddy see? The war was long over, the empire rebuilt. Now he owned and managed much of the property in the town and even more throughout the county. He had what he wanted, and his work suited him perfectly. Now it's my turn, I shouted into the wind. I want my own life and my own vision. A seagull swooped in toward me before turning direction at the last second and landing on top of an empty dock piling stacked with other birds. Their freedom and grace pulled at my being. Within 15 minutes, I was in the widest part of the river, headed to a place almost as far away from civilization and Daddy as I could get. Sitting on a hummock of land on a deep, swiftly flowing creek, edged on two sides by green-feathered marsh and to the rear by a density of coastal trees and shrubs, this camp was a refuge from the increasing demands and early signs of encroaching civilization on a quiet southern town. The camp itself was nothing more than an expanded lean-to, haphazardly upgraded over the years, closely resembling a sharecropper shack. I came to this place with Daddy 100 times over the years, back when we were close. Now it remained the only part of him I still understood. A half hour after leaving home, I arrived at the fish camp. After tying up the boat, I walked toward the house, aware of the familiar sounds of nature that surrounded me as the darkness swallowed their shape. Aunt Amelia, my mother's only sister, and her husband, Uncle Hamp, were already there waiting for me. They were staying at the camp for one last weekend before heading to their second home near Asheville, North Carolina. This unusual couple lived only 2 houses down from me my whole life. I was at their house almost as much as mine, mostly because they loved and accepted me without reservation. I could tell them anything. Back when Mama still had her sense of humor in her less oppressive years, we often joked that I was actually Aunt Amelia's child birthed through my mother's womb. Diminutive in stature like my mama, my aunt met me at the door, studied my face for a moment, and gave me a long, strong hug. She was an earth mother herbalist and almost always wore loose khaki pants, a long gauze blouse, and her pewter and enamel amulet necklace to keep away trouble for the clientele who believed in her. You look upset, she said. Go sit on the porch and I'll be there in a minute. I nodded. In the kitchen, I heard Uncle Hamp, a tall, gangly, jolly man about 50 years old, clanging pots, dropping utensils, and letting out an intermittent damage while he prepared his seafood specialties for Frogmore stew. As her business production and delivery manager, he was her rock in every aspect of her life, she often told me. Aunt Amelia soon came out carrying cups of tea. Whenever there was something significant going on, Aunt Amelia brewed her special tea. Even if it was 100 degrees outside, she believed in the tea's healing power. After handing a cup to me, she sat in the weather-beaten rocker next to mine. Dusk was a reverent time of day to us, and we respected and participated in the growing darkness with our silence. Only a few hundred yards away, across another hummock of land, we heard the rhythmic movement of the ocean caressing the shoreline to the east. In the distance, the unmistakable flop, flop, flop of deer hooves in wet marsh drew my attention to their outlines as they moved single file near the maritime forest. A breeze rustled leaves in the giant oaks that clung to the land like a mother to her child. I sensed nature settling into the evening all around me, but I was far from settling. I still churned from Daddy's words and mine. Each incoming wave and its retreat entered the pulse of my body. And Amelia broke the silence. "What did he say, Nadine?" she asked, still looking out into the darkness. Her graying shoulder-length hair lifted off her shoulders by a magenta bandana made her look more like a queen than my aunt. "The short version?" He said, "No." I took a sip from my cup. "That's all?" she asked. "No, of course not." Sam Barnwell didn't speak long, but he was quite clear. I mimicked his voice, repeating his angry words. "First," he said, "I wasn't talented enough. Second, that I'm not moving to New York City. And third, to get rid of that boy." I paused, barely able to form the next word. "And fourth, if I left anyway, not to ever come back." Feeling the slap of those words all over again, I wrapped both hands around the warm mug, put my feet up on the wood slat in the center of the screen porch, and rocked.
Oh, that is so beautiful.
Thank you.
Feel like clapping here.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
Oh my gosh, I could just sit back and you could read to me. How's that? Wow, you really get that juxtaposition of the South, and then she's heading toward the bustling New York lifestyle, and your cover speaks very well to that as well. Let's talk about your Leah.
And my cover recently won a gold award online at a very big website that's known for that. It's thebookdesigner.com. Joel Friedlander, if book designers submit their covers, he will critique them. He will tell you what's wrong with them, and then once a month, he'll give a gold and a silver award. And so the month of March, my book cover won the gold award.
Wow.
Every other cover in the whole world that was submitted. So I was really thrilled with that. This designer, who I've never met, lives in, I believe it's Oregon, and he and I just worked together on what the cover should look like. I had a description in my mind, and I said, if I could actually draw what you do, this is what I would do. And I would have Nadine going up the creek
in the boat,
going out to the fish camp in the oak trees on the side, and I would have her dreaming of New York City, which you see the skyline off in the distance. And then she wants to be as free as the birds, and he just pulled the whole thing together so beautifully. And he went back and researched the 1970s style so that he caught what that style was at that time for book covers.
I don't even have a word to describe that. It was very rich. When I saw that cover, and then having you read that passage from it, I almost felt like I was watching.
You were going up the river with her then, right?
I was. I felt like I was watching a movie. I was getting more of a visual sensation.
Oh, good, good. That's what I want to hear. And this is his James Egan, and it's booksavvy.com.
Mm, mm, mm.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's my publicist. He's bookfly.com.
Bookfly.
I guess they're both a book thing. Bookfly is the cover. Book Savvy is my publicist.
Well, if that doesn't entice people to want to read that book, we're done. Thank you so much for sharing that. Well, now let's take a moment maybe and talk about some book marketing ideas, because I know that you conduct writers groups and offer advice to other writers and other authors, how to improve their book, how to market their book. Let's just go there for our last few minutes.
All right. Well, you know, each year, or maybe even each 6 months or less, the whole world of book marketing, you know, morphs a little bit more. And so I had put together a book marketing seminar that I would do, like a three-hour seminar that I would do, and try to explain to people that they need to be online, that you can only go so far with your immediate local community and, of course, family. And then after that, that you need to expand. And depending on the age of the person and the amount of technology they've ever actually allowed themselves to get into, it, you know, sometimes it just stops right there in front of me and it won't go any further. And in anymore, it's, you know, you're not gonna sell it by the book tour alone. You're certainly, where do you even put ads anymore? What are people reading? They're not reading newspapers like they used to because there's so many other places. So there's a wide variety of places that you have to do a little bit in each one of them. You have to have a newsletter. You have to engage, you know, people who want to know about you and your book. You can't overwhelm them, but you have to engage on social media. And Facebook has cut back in a lot of ways in how much your post will be shared with your friends. So there are Facebook ads, and there's Facebook tracking of the different kinds of titles and content that you put in the ad and times that you post it. Then there's the Twitter also is not sharing your tweets with as many of your followers as you think they are, but there are other ways to engage, and you have to kind of do a study of all this. There's Pinterest, and of course there's Instagram. LinkedIn is probably not such a good platform for fiction, more for nonfiction, if you're going to look at LinkedIn. You have to have your own website, so people will go there. You need a sign-up form. There's a lot to do. And then there are some book talks. And I'm working now, once I've done my launch party celebration, where I had just an overwhelming amount of people come to it. It was just fabulous. And then you want to get your reviews. You want to get as many reviews on Amazon as you can. So you've got to go back to the people who told you, wow, this is such a great book. I didn't even put it down, which I can't tell you how many people actually took the time to email me back and tell me that. I was just really tickled. Now I need to convert all of them into just put that little bit on Amazon. Let those reviews build up so that Amazon starts paying a little bit of attention. So you have to really kind of look at all of the platforms where you could be and do a little bit of all of them. But don't take away from your life, whatever you do. Don't take away from your day job, and don't take away from your family. Those two things you're not going to replace with marketing your book. That I can tell you.
Right. It's a different world now with the self-publishing as well. So you can't really rely on anyone else. And so now you are not only the author, but you're the marketer. And that takes quite a talent and a lot of time, as you mentioned.
Yep. It is. And you have to have the interest. And I know lots of people that I've taught, and they get it out there. They get it on Kindle, and they get some copies made, and they have, you know, they sell a few of them, and then they're done.
Yeah.
They don't want to be done, but they don't know where to go next, and they don't have the ability to carry forward. Mm-hmm. And so it's the, you know, it's that same 10% that do the most of the work. You know, that rule.
That rule, yes.
It's going to be the same thing in marketing your book.
Yep.
Whether you're, you know, as a first-time author, whether you're traditionally published or self-published, you've got a lot of legwork to do. Mm-hmm. You really do. But spread it out. It can build over time.
Sure.
It doesn't have to happen all at once.
Exactly. So that's excellent advice. Thank you for sharing that. So for you, what's next for Stephanie Edwards?
Well, I have a second novel that's about three-quarters of the way done. And between finalizing this one and publishing it and launching it and marketing it, You know, where am I getting the time to continue that? And it's getting close, and it's a different story altogether. Although one of the characters in my in What We Set in Motion does show up in this second one, which is titled Oyster Island, and it takes place right here in the Lowcountry of South Carolina and doesn't go anywhere else. And in this case, a young girl is about to graduate from high school, and she's living with her grandmother and comes home one day, and her grandmother is knocked out on the floor and bleeding from the temple, and the house is in disarray. And we go from there to find out, what were they looking for? What do they want? Will they come back? Mm-hmm. And this young girl just got a scholarship to the Nashville School of Songwriting, and she was so excited to come home and tell her grandmother about it. And when she sees her grandmother on the kitchen floor with the blood coming out of her temple, the piece of paper goes up in the air, floats down, and gets sucked under the refrigerator.
Oh. Oyster Island. All right. We're going to keep our fingers crossed for that one soon. Well, now, is there anything that we missed that you would like to talk about today?
I think one thing that it'd be, you know, they always talk about who's your audience. It's very important to zero in on your audience, but then with some marketing also. And so people that might have lived through the 70s and maybe been to New York or the Lowcountry, et cetera, but I'm finding that my book has a wider appeal. I'm finding people in their 20s are reading it with the same verve and passion that people in their 40s, 50s, 60s are reading this book and saying, oh, wow. This really resonates with me, and that feels very special. So whereas some books are very, as we know, age specific or gender specific, I'm finding, and you don't know until this comes out and people start reading it, you don't necessarily know all of that. I'm finding that it's hitting a good note with a lot of groups. Mm-hmm. And I like that. I like that it has a more of a universal feel to it. Because overcoming the obstacles of following your own dream is not so easy.
No.
You can make the choice, and you can be very talented. And because I worked in New York City for so long, and I saw so many talented people, and I saw some people rose up the ladder, at least temporarily, and others never moved from the place I met them or moved back down, you don't know. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with talent or look. It's something else entirely, and it's a more and more, you know, it's more elusive than that, I guess,
yes.
Is what I want to say.
Yes.
And you kind of got to go with that part of the flow of life. But if there are obstacles, choices are your destiny.
Yes.
You got a choice every time.
I was just going to end with that. Choices are our destiny. I love that. All right. Well, now, where can folks learn more about you, and where can they purchase your book?
Well, my website is StephanieAustinEdwards.com, and that's Austin with an I, like the city. And then online, almost every online retailer is carrying my book, I would say, certainly the major ones. And in any bookstore, you should be able to, if they don't have it, you should be able to have it ordered and get it in a couple of days. It is available, so it's really quite available out there. You know, you're in the brick and mortar store, you're always fighting the big guys, the people who have been around for a very, very long time.
Right.
And, you know, you're fighting for that space. So the debut author is not necessarily going to be something that they're putting out. But I did have a television interview, which I thought was so interesting, that I was asked to do. I'm down in Beaufort, South Carolina, and in Charleston, South Carolina, which is a much bigger market. The CBS affiliate station up there called me up the week of my launch party and my book launch, and asked me to do an interview up there, which was really, really exciting.
Exciting. Oh, so many good things on the horizon for you. So I encourage everyone to get a copy of your book, What We Set in Motion. You could find it at your website, StephanieAustinEdwards.com. Stephanie, what a pleasure to meet you. And just the reading of the bit of that chapter just moved me so, and I really appreciate that. I'm glad we took the time to do that. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Pat. This was wonderful.